This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. This week's episode was recorded on November 29th, 2015. On this week's episode, Nick White,
hey,
Paul Jaisley,
hello,
and myself started the episode talking about our comic picks for the week. Then we ended up taking a bit of time talking about what we read in the last week, which was actually a lot. There's talk of The Dark Knight 3, The Master Race number 1, and we ended up leading ourselves into a conversation about one-shots. As you may notice, we're trying a new format this week, so if you hate it or love it, let us know. I'll be adding a survey to our site this week, and if you hear this episode before December 31st, we'd love it if you filled the survey out. And if you provide your email at the end, I'll give you a comic book from Comixology out of my own pocket. Go to destroythesybe.org/survey to fill it out, and there'll be a link in the show notes. And now, this week's episode. So this week, comic books are coming out on December 2nd, 2015, despite my thinking it was December 4th earlier today. What are you guys reading for this week? What are you excited for?
Well, I'm excited for a new Daredevil comic, because it's been a few years since we had a new Daredevil number one. According to my calculations, this is the third Daredevil number one in about 5 years. So
That puts it pretty low on the amount of reboots, right? I mean, we joke about that, but 3 and 5 sounds pretty reasonable for a Marvel title.
Interesting because they
only
rebooted
three.
They renumbered it halfway through Mark Waid's run for kind of no reason. So they kind of had to squeeze. I guess they're like, well, we haven't rebooted this book in a while. I guess it's time for new number one. But this number one,
I guess,
is part of the all new, all different Marvel. Even though the book itself is not. Doesn't have a different name, you know. It's not the Uncanny Daredevil or the Amazing Daredevil or whatever. It's just Daredevil number one, written by Charles Soule and art by Ron Garney. I loved Mark Waid's run so much. I'm a little apprehensive because I thought that book ended perfectly. It's kind of a wonderful, self-contained, multi-year run on this character that I've always wanted to like, but never really did. I'm not a fan of the grim and gritty Daredevil that Brian Michael Bendis did, but Mark Waid's take on the character is perfect. I'm interested to see, though, how Charles Soule is able to update the character or take it in a different direction.
Oh, it's going to be all lawyers all the time,
which is
I'm totally cool with that.
Which is great, because I absolutely loved his She-Hulk comic so much, and that's really what it was. It was driven by Soule's own background as being a lawyer, so he got a very heavy, without being too, you know, over the top, a very in-depth look at what it actually means to be a lawyer. Writing Matt Murdock makes perfect sense. I'm very excited to read that. I think Soule's not like an amazing writer, but he's a very solid writer, and I think he'll have a good take on this character given his own personal background.
Yeah, so do you think that they're going to try to update this book? Admittedly, I have like looked at none of the post-Secret Wars stuff except for the X-Men, because that's like all I really care about coming out of Secret Wars. So do you think that this is going to be like, is it going to be tied to the TV show in some way? Are they going to try to, or at least have anything you've seen, has it been like, oh, we're updating him to look like what's his name, who's playing Daredevil on the TV show, like they're kind of doing with Jessica Jones?
Yeah,
Charlie Cox.
Well, I haven't seen too much of the interior art, so I don't know if that's the big change. But as far as the description of the book I've read, they're not going to tie it into the TV show too much, as far as I can tell. He's back in New York. The last year or so, Wade's run, he was in San Francisco. So he's back
in New York. California.
Yeah. So he's back in New York, so I guess that's like the show. And then it looks like it's going to be a little bit grittier, more street level, like the character kind of classically has been in the past couple decades. Mm-hmm. But that's not too tied to the TV show, as far as I can tell, because where the main hook based on the solicitation is that he has a sidekick now, Daredevil.
What?
And he has well, the thing is, he has a sidekick named Blindspot, but in the solicit...
Oh, is that the kid that Wade created?
That sounds offensive.
In his run?
Is that supposed to be offensive?
Okay.
No,
okay.
I don't think so. I don't remember this character at all.
Who's this Blindspot?
I'm not sure who it is. They're kind of keeping it under wraps, his origin or whatever, his background. But in the solicitation, they're calling him the devil's advocate, which is a little too on the nose, you know?
I like that better than Blind Spot. Because like with Blind Spot, you're not even going to have the conversation of, we need to figure out his weakness. Well, sir,
right. Yeah.
I think they sort of did that for us.
Well,
you know, and that also doesn't cover the whole issue of, like, you know, shouldn't you have a sidekick who, like, makes up for your own, like, deficiencies?
Yeah.
Hey, well, you know, a daredevil's blind, but I wouldn't call it this deficiency. I would say that it's just, like, one subtraction for four benefits. I don't know.
Well, it's interesting because I think Mark Wade, his run put a big premium on the idea of him having a disability. He really kind of explored that idea more deeply than I think a lot of writers have in the past. Mark Waid's run also wasn't afraid of being just a straight up kind of goofy at times superheroes book. I have a feeling that Charles Sewell's a writer that's able to kind of split that difference, given his background as a lawyer, is able to have it grounded in actual judicial legal system, you know, and also have a sort of superhero spin on it where you can have kind of a sidekick and have it not feel out of place for that character. So,
yeah,
I mean, both Sewell and Garney are very workmanlike, you know, in their approach. I don't mean that as a put down, but they're not like my favorite creators, but they're solid in what they do and they're able to deliver on time, you know? So I'm excited. I think it'd be a good book. I read all Wade's run. I absolutely loved it. So this would be one of the few times I've continued with a book after a radical change of the creative team. So,
right. No, that'll be. I can't say that I won't be willing to check it out. I mean, Charles Soule is exactly as you described him, where he's never written anything that I thought was like, oh my gosh, this is the greatest thing in the entire world. I feel like. Well, maybe that's not so true, at least over his Marvel stuff. I never really got into She-Hulk. Yeah, I'd be really interested to see how he would take Daredevil and manage the lawyer side of things as well as the crime fighter side of things.
And that difference he splits is what made She-Hulk work for me. It was a sort of goofy, over-the-top comic book, but it was rooted and it felt like he knew what he was talking about. Jennifer Walters sounded like a lawyer when she talked. So I think it would be a good fit for Matt Murdock.
Gotcha.
I just love that, like, Paul is, like, really rooting for this sort of angle of Daredevil. And then it's, like, him and, like, five other people. And then everyone else is like, what the fuck? Less of that law shit, man. More ass-kicking. And Paul's like, if we could include more subpoenas and a couple more, legal backroom court proceedings, that would be great. I'd like more Grisham in my Daredevil.
Let's get about 12 pages an issue of just cross-examination. That'd be wonderful.
Right? Yeah, my gosh.
Paul's like, I'll pay an extra $2 if at the back of the document they include all of the legal briefs. That would be fantastic.
Yeah.
And everyone else is like, what is this shit?
I'm paying an extra dollar for just paper?
He's not hitting anyone with a baton on this page. It's crap.
Yeah. Nick, what are you reading this week? What's got you excited?
I'm pretty pumped for Pacific Rim Tales from the Drift number 2, which in another excellent segment of Nick White thought he knew what he was reading and then found out he was also pretty uninformed. I thought this was supposed to be taking place after the movie Pacific Rim, but after reading number 1 and getting kind of confused and saying, I don't think this is after the movie,
The Jaeger are still alive, right? Like... I thought they all died in the movie,
kaiju,
pretty much.
The kaiju.
Both, really.
So I went back and did some research, and it turns out that I not only thought this was an ongoing, and it's a miniseries, but it also takes place after the, what I think was called Pacific Rim Zero, which was the tie-in graphic novel for the movie, which maybe at some point I will buy when I fail to understand the concept of money or get wealthy enough, because it's like $20 and it's like 60 pages and I am not going to do that. That's really? Not happening.
Wow. Yeah, have some respect, man. Yeah. Have some self-respect, I should say.
Yeah, I mean, it could be like 80 pages and like $15. It's definitely not any more generous than that spotting, but that's still like, yeah. So, that being said,
still excited for this book, though.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, really, I mean, it's two-thirds of the iVampire team, which everyone's like, okay, what the fuck is iVampire? Well, it's
yeah,
another
that's,
one.
That's
of,
what I'm thinking.
Yeah, it was another one of the DC. It's another one of the New 52's interesting experiments that, amazingly enough, I think made it to about the 19 issue mark. It launched with the launch of the New 52, and it was Joshua Hale. I'll butcher this one. Fyakalov on writing. And it was Andrea Sorrentino's like first big DC gig, to my knowledge.
Oh,
before.
Wow.
This okay. is what got him like the early accolades that got him put on Green Arrow. So he was doing iVampire. And that being said, on this book, we also have, on Pacific Rim, we also have Joshua Hale, Fyakalov. No Sorrentino, but we do have his colorist, Marcelo Maiolo. And you definitely, I think the penciler's name is Marco Mars, and you definitely see a bit of a resemblance to Sorrentino, even to some extent. It's not as stylized, but it's got Marcelo Maiolo's traditional reds and greens color palette and sort of the desaturated panels. And
right.
I
that
really
was
like
super
it.
Prevalent on in Green Arrow. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So there's a lot of that again. I don't mind. It's much like the movie. It's not like, you know, it's hard to figure out who the hero is. It's sort of the narrative is split up between the scientists that are trying to get the information and the Jaeger pilots that are having to fight the kaiju. So the narrative is sort of this split narrative, just like the movie was, you know,
Charlie
Hunnam's
Day
character and Charlie Day's
yeah.
character. Exactly. yeah. The Charlies. And
good.
Exactly. And it's like the movie. It's definitely not go-lucky. It's definitely not happy. Like, bad shit goes down. Like, the main Jaeger gets, like, hit and starts leaking, like, radiation poisoning in the cockpit of this husband and wife that are working together. And it's fucking bleak as hell, which I'm loving it. It's really dark. And just enjoying it. I think, once again, I know Xander and I have these discussions all the time. I think we even just had one yesterday, but anyone who wants to have the ongoing debate about, you know, is it lazy, is it stupid, is the quality there or not when it comes to adapting a pre-existing franchise into a comic, I think at least 7 times out of 10 these days, honestly, I'm really impressed with the results. I think a lot of these publishers know that readers are much more critical, and if they throw some hack on the book or someone who doesn't really know what they're doing, or maybe someone who doesn't write for the show or maybe doesn't really care about the material, it's going to show, and people aren't going to show up. So
gotcha.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's an interesting shot out there for legendary comics or legendary picture comics or whatever they're calling themselves, I guess.
Wait, so this isn't being published under like IDW or anything like that? This is like an independent publishing company that's doing it?
Yeah, Legendary, you know, Legendary, the
Legendary Pictures, right, okay.
Has their own little comic branch, and that's who's doing this, so.
Oh,
yeah,
that's
and
cool. I feel like
enough,
I didn't know that yeah. that existed.
Yeah, and the weird thing for me that really surprised me is, and I'd have to go check this again, I'm like 90% certain, they're just not restricted to strictly comic book output of their own pre-existing film/TV media stuff. It's they've got some of their own original stuff as well.
Yeah,
so,
they published the 6-issue miniseries that Grant Morrison and Fraser Irving did last year.
Oh,
Annihilator. Yeah.
Oh.
That was on Legendary. Okay. Which is why it was very hard for me to track down. But,
gotcha.
Yeah.
Minor tangent. Sorry. No, have you read Annihilator? I keep seeing it on the shelves, and it's like 30 bucks, but it's a big book, and, you know, I know nothing, so.
I grabbed the first 4 issues, and I read those, and I've since picked up issues 5 and 6, you know, like months after the fact.
Right.
I've been meaning to sit down and just read it start to finish. I just haven't had time yet.
Okay.
So the issues I did read were fantastic, though. I really,
and it's one of those
really
weird,
what is
like
this
meta
story
things,
even about?
Right? It's like a really stressed out, burnt out writer who comes to terms with his creation coming to life,
oh, God.
Or him jumping yeah. into the creation, something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, basically, it's a you know, a flash. It's a young upstart screenwriter who had this big success with his first movie. He's struggling to write his second script, and the character that he's writing
is Max Landis suing this guy yet? Because
no,
like,
right?
Yeah, lost Max Landis as a listener.
And it's that, and it's also Morrison. It's, you know, Animal Man visiting Morrison at the end of Grant Morrison's Animal Man run. It's
right.
kind of a very similar thing. I think it's treading a lot of the same ground that Nameless is and doing it better in a way, but
oh.
that's only based on the few issues I read from memory. So I think it's worth tracking down, but again, I'll pretty much read anything Grant Morrison writes, so maybe I'm not the best.
That's true.
Judge
sometimes I forget that. Yeah.
You've got Grant Morrison. I've got Warren Ellis. Nick has Jeff Lemire. I mean, and Matt Kent. Yeah. So there you know, we all have our vices. It's fine.
That's right.
Yeah, it's okay.
speaking of Jeff Lemire, let's just perfectly segue this into I'm reading Extraordinary X-Men number 3 this week, and I don't give a fuck who cares because honestly, this book is fantastic, and everyone who's shitting on it can just go away from me, please. Because I am loving this book. It feels like what the X-Men were 6-7 years ago. And in fact, I just read an article from the AV Club that was all about how the X-Men have been basically pooped on by Marvel in the last, like, 5 years. And it's kind of true, but at the same time, that's the X-Men shtick. Like, they're always the underdogs. They're always the people that are being hunted down. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with playing to that trope for them. And this book is exactly that.
It's just part of an overarching narrative, yeah. It's like, Marvel's like, no, this isn't, like, we're not showing bias or anything. We're, you know, we're putting the chip back on their shoulder, so...
Yeah,
you
they're
really
playing
ought to
the
just,
cards
you know,
that everyone knows they have. Yeah, like,
just keep bowing down in veneration to us, really.
Yeah.
We know what
the
we're
biggest,
doing.
The biggest thing about this book is I'm really waiting for it to... I'm really waiting for all of the subsequent X-Men books that are coming out in December and January to be released. The new Uncanny X-Men, the new All New X-Men. I think there's like one or two other X-Men books coming out, and I'm all for reading them. Like I'm totally that sucker who like has been missing his heroin for far too long, and now he's finally getting it back after being weaned off of it.
Wow!
And
junkie who's finally clean, and then
yeah. And then someone goes, hey, look, no, it's back. It's easy to get. And I go, oh,
hey,
okay,
bud.
Thanks.
Hey, bud. Thanks. First one's free.
But the thing about this book that I think makes it great is the fact that Jeff Lemire is doing all the interpersonal stuff in the midst of a greater narrative, which is exactly what I expect out of an X-Men book. And at times it feels a little clunky because he tries to make things uplifting and like happy, kind of.
Really?
Or like he tries to... not necessarily
know your roots, man.
Yeah, but it's more like, it's more as if he just wants to, like, drop jokes into very, very bleak situations between characters that have the capability for these types of jokes. And for instance, Colossus and Magic, brother and sister, they have been just kind of joking back and forth about, like, who's becoming an old grump like their dad or how... I don't know, like they fall to these Russian stereotypes because they're Russian, and it's kind of funny, but meanwhile, the story, what's actually happening is they're trying to find Nightcrawler, who may or may not be dead in the sewers where these, where they
fine.
May be inhumans,
he's
they
fine.
May be mutants.
They know
trying
it too,
to kill
that's
them.
Why they're making jokes, it's
yeah.
Nightcrawler.
And I think so far, Jeff Lemire has done a good job of trying to ease, or bridge the gap between Bendis's end of Uncanny X-Men in this one, and it's very subtle and it's very slight, but I think that he's doing a good job trying to mend ties while we're waiting for the other books to ramp up. So everyone on Reddit and various blog websites like have just been shitting on this book, and I am absolutely loving it. So maybe I'm ignorant and naive and I just wanted my X-Men back, and I'll take anything whether it's good or bad. But I really like this book. I know you guys don't care about X-Men, but this is, like, the book for me.
Well, Mike, if we cared about X-Men, then you wouldn't, you know, be able to continually put that, you know, chip on your shoulder. So, again, much like Marvel's treatment of Fox's movies, we're basically recreating that same sort of relationship for you. So,
yeah.
What I'm saying is you're welcome. so, do we have any updates at all on them attempting to what? Unravel this 8-month mystery or 6-month mystery of what happened? Or is this book not
really?
I mean,
for the most part, I would say there's very minor, I don't know, like things. But it's almost as if like everyone forgot that what happened to the X-Men back in after House of M. And now we're like, and then all of the strides that the X-Men made to try to get away from this like stigma of them being like these hated things, and instead everyone kind of, I don't know, I felt like there was this moment where like the X-Men were embraced by the world, and now they've just washed all of that away, and we've gotten back to the point where people are like, oh, you're a mutie, I can't even touch you, I can't be around you, you might give me, I mean, there's a legitimate M-pox that's out there, so maybe it's understandable to an extent.
Chlamydia.
Yeah, well, they're calling it Mpox, Nick. Not Mpox? Muti chlamydia. Really?
There was some chlamydia sounds a lot better. yeah. Mpox sounds like they're making it. They're mining it for cheap laughs, and this is serious. This ought to be taken seriously, as any Muti outbreak chlamydia? Should.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But
chlamydia.
Chlamydia. Ooh, that's a good one. Ooh, that's a good one.
Good
that's,
one.
That's
fucking straight.
That's a show title right there. Chlamydia.
Now, again, remind me, like you said, because of this, all of them are now sterile. Like, it didn't kill anybody. It just rendered them all.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, it made them all sterile. And which, again, I read this AV Club article and it totally, like, slapped me in the face.
Which is always the immutable truth. I mean, like, if you walk around on the internet with an AV Club article in your hand, everyone's like, fuck, don't fuck with this guy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, anyway. I mean, to be honest, their coverage of comic books is actually pretty good. And their bit about what happened between, like, 2001 when Grant Morrison, you know, had 3 years of insanity on the X-Men, and now it kind of reminded me that there was, like, we've come so far, and now we're just back at step one again.
Started from the bottom,
and now we're back at the bottom, and how did we ever get out of here in the first place? Oh, wait, they took the ladder. We're stuck in this pit. Yeah. And that's...
Are those the rest of the lyrics of the Drake song?
Yes.
Okay.
So it's been interesting, and I mean, I just read Extraordinary X-Men number 2 because I was way behind on comics, and so reading 2 followed, I mean, it has me super excited about 3, which is me basically saying, let's talk about what we read this week, because I read an Extraordinary X-Men number 2, as well as a bunch of other stuff, but before I start ranting about how much I loved Constantine number 6, what did you guys think about, or what have you guys read this week?
Well, I read Ringside number 1, which was my pick of the week, comics pick from last week on the show, and I really, really enjoyed it.
Oh, dude, I read that book, too. You talked about it and got me all excited about it, so I picked up the number 1. I kind of really liked it way more than I thought I was going to, but I'll let you continue before I go off on it.
Yeah, this is the book that's sort of the look at the, you know, the life of the wrestlers outside of the wrestling ring, quote unquote, you know, that's the pull quote, I guess. And it delivered on that regard. As a pro wrestling fan, a noted pro wrestling fan on this podcast, I wish there'd been a little bit more wrestling in it, if that makes sense. I understand why they didn't do that. I understand that they needed the hook to be the characters themselves. And the ending of the book, I was like, well, I'd rather it be more focused on the day-to-day lives of the wrestlers, but I understand you needed to have a big hook at the end to get the larger story involved. But
yeah,
I did like that it was a very honest portrayal of that. I mean, there was a lot of references that I don't know if maybe casual wrestling fans or non-fans would get that I noticed. You know, they're talking backstage about whoever's selling the most t-shirts is the one that's going to be in the main event.
Oh,
that
dude.
Really happens. And then there was an episode, the moment when they're...
Pay to play.
The moment when they're in the restaurant, they're at a diner, like a Greasy Spoon kind of diner, and they all order, you know, grilled chicken breasts and vegetables because they're eating clean because they're wrestlers trying to watch their weight. Yeah. Little things like that. They obviously did their research. I really enjoyed that. And I like the artwork. It's a little looser and sketchier than I normally would dig, but I think it captured the sort of energy of the sequences really well. And I'm looking forward to there being more in-ring, you know, portrayals of the actual matches and stuff, hopefully.
Yeah, that was works. The art was one thing that shook me when I didn't even look at the art before I picked up the book. Like, I was going solely off of your recommendation, Paul, when I picked it up.
Okay.
And the art kind of threw me in some panels where I was like, what is he trying to draw here? But then there were other panels, like, for instance, when they introduced, I don't know who this guy was supposed to be. In my head, I thought Macho Man Randy Savage, the dude with his goatee. And to me, like, that was the perfect portrayal of, like, what old wrestlers look like. Like, and I'm not even really a wrestling fan by any means, despite how often I tell Paul I'm going to actually go out and watch wrestling.
Yeah.
And that guy right there, they were showing, you know, two characters side by side, the old wrestler and the younger wrestler. And, like, the way that they were drawn on their first, like, depiction was, like, perfect for me. Like, not knowing too much about wrestling, I was like, that to me says new old wrestler versus old wrestler. And just the dialogue, the way the older guy talked, like, it felt way real.
Yeah.
More real than I could have imagined. Like, none of it felt inauthentic, I guess.
Yeah, that's what it really struck me. That's what really struck me is they obviously did their research and they really capture, you know, I watch a lot of interviews with guys, older wrestlers after they retire, and they do these, you know, interviews where they're very honest and candid, and the language, the words that they use, the jargon, the cadence of even how they talk, they captured a lot of that in the book really, really well. It's clear that Joe Keating really did his research and is really treating this with this topic and this subject matter, which could be laughed off and seen as silly. He's treating it with a lot of respect, which I obviously appreciate being a fan. Yeah. So,
yeah, it's a good book. I mean, I'm really interested, given how the book ended, I'm really curious to see where it's going to go, because it took a twist in the last like four pages that I was like, holy shit, this is what is this really about wrestling?
Yeah.
So that was really cool. But
yeah, I enjoyed that quite a bit.
Anything else you were really excited about that you read about?
Fade Out number 11. I know this is the second to last issue. I'm kind of sad to see this book end soon, although I have no doubts that Brubaker and Phillips will pull out all the stops for that final issue.
Totally.
Yeah. Love that book. Black Magic number 2. I really like this book. And again, I've mentioned on the show before, I'm a big Greg Rucka fan, but Lazarus didn't work for me, and I know both you guys really enjoyed Lazarus.
This makes me so mad every time you say this. Every time. I think I'm over it, and then you just say those words, and I'm like, how does this even make sense?
It just didn't click for me. But Black Magic, this is exactly what I want from a Greg Rucka book. Maybe I'm narrow-minded, but this is the kind of book that Greg Rucka writes that is my bread and butter. I absolutely loved it. I thought it was fantastic. Obviously, I picked up Dark Knight 3, The Master Race. Should we dive into that?
We're going to hold off for that. We're going to hold on to that. I've got...
Okay.
Well, I want Nick to have a moment to speak before you and I just push him out of the picture for a while.
So I know that...
Oh, if you think I won't contribute to a conversation about a book and a legacy of books upon which I have read none and have no interest, you're wrong. I will give my unsubstantiated opinion.
There is one book I read that I know that Nick also read. I read issue 2 of Art Ops, and I see that you read issue 1. So what did you think of issue 1 of Art Ops, Nick?
Yeah, I just picked up 2 yesterday. Really, really excited for that. Art Ops number 1, for me, really needs to go down for the very awkwardly phrased trophy I hand out of Nick White's book within the last couple of months, which was a lot better than I thought it would be, and that's kind of good trophy. It's a big trophy.
Wow.
I mean, the statue is small because those are expensive, but the little caption thing that you engrave, that's bigger. It has to be. Yeah, I tried to explain Art Ops to Xander yesterday, where I was like, this book is really good. Like, you know, a lot of these like big public figureheads have doubles that look like them. Well, what if paintings had doubles, and what if there's this secret art organization that needs to protect these people, and this guy's like, he has a latchkey childhood and his mom works for this organization, and then he gets like jumped and his arm gets cut off, but they like recreate it with like paint and it's like super powerful, but if he doesn't take the antidote every week, like his arm will go away, and it's really cool.
What the
cool
fuck
and...
are you even talking about?
Exactly.
Right now?
And that was Xander's reaction, and he said, that's too much, man. That's too much.
Yeah.
But it's wacky and it's goofy, and honestly, I think like a lot of people, I came to this book really for the artwork.
Right.
A lot of the time, we're just fortunate to get Michael Allred covers these days. It's a rare, rare occasion when you actually get page after page after page of interiors. But the writing was actually really, really good, and I think the premise is kind of fun. And I'm always interested to see sort of a subtle venture into a realm of study or interest that I don't know much in, but the writer knows I don't know that much, and so it's just going to be very carefully laid out for me. And of course, I don't spend a lot of time in art museums. I realize if I did, I would probably be able to throw that weight around more, but I don't. And so
yeah,
the
could
idea
bring
that
it up in any conversation and it wouldn't be weird.
You'd be like, you know what, this chicken, it reminds me of last week when I went to this art museum and I looked at all the paintings and I studied all of the cards next to them, and I can tell you the significance of each.
You're really selling this, Nick.
Really selling this.
Yeah. No, it was great. It was fun. Like I said, paintings and art and all of that is sort of a subculture that I don't really delve into that much. And so I think this will be a fun sort of learning experience on top of being a beautiful, trippy, weird art. And I think at some point this book will probably get oddly meta for one reason or another, but yeah.
Oh no, because it's Mike Allred, and that's pretty much what all of his books
exactly,
are nowadays.
Exactly. The fourth wall will be broken eventually. It's just a guarantee. No, really fun, really beautiful. I think Valiant. I think, wow, what's always on my mind, Valiant. I think Vertigo has really just, with this recent batch of number ones over the last month or two, they have just been fucking knocking it out of the park left and right, and I'm really, really impressed, and I think it is one of the things that's really going under the radar right now.
What else came out from Vertigo that was, like, super killer?
Clean Room.
Oh, I heard about that, yeah.
That's getting a lot of press.
Unfollow? Is that the other one? The Unfollow? I haven't read that yet.
I was
yet,
so close to picking that book up. Yeah. I can't,
of course,
I
Grant Morrison's Whatchamacallit, that's been around for a couple more months. Wait, is that Vertigo? That's Image. Is Nameless Image?
Nameless is Image, yeah.
Yeah, there's a couple more right around the corner. There's like a Red Thorn one about like, I forget what that one's about. There's a few other people are talking about that aren't completely on my radar, but yeah, Art Ops, really good, really fun. Vertigo is reinventing themselves pretty well with, you know, Fables gone and
what's the other that sort ended. Of... I forgot that ended.
Yeah, their mainstay.
I mean, I haven't read any of that book. I always thought of it as like a staple that just like Vertigo will always be publishing Fables and it's always going to be in the previous book, and I'm just going to always ignore it.
Well, I mean, when you think about it, I mean, after their big titles went away, Hellblazer, which I guess was more recent than Nod, and Sandman and whatnot, Fables was really sort of the holdover for them, really.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I mean,
so,
that was their mainstay for a really long time. It was their, absolutely. Like, Why the Last Man or Ex Machina in the same boat. Were books that just ran for a long time. It was kind of like a staple for them. But, hey, they're just banking on something being their next big one, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I hope number two wasn't any sort of weird, out-of-the-blue, massive meltdown for you, Paul. I mean,
no, I thought it was fantastic. If nothing, it got more weird, which I always appreciate. I mean, that's one thing that... I admire the really early Vertigo stuff because there wasn't a precedence for it, so they had no choice but to be off the wall and weird.
Right.
So I don't know if either of you have read Grant Morrison's Doom Patrol, but there's a that book really set the precedent for what Vertigo became because it came out right before Vertigo sort of started.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like
was
a three...
that Wildstorm or
I was
or...
Say,
no,
wasn't
just DC.
Doom Patrol
just
technically
DC.
Just
oh,
a
Doom
DC
Patrol
book.
Technically was DC. You're right.
DC. Yeah.
But there was like a 3 or 4 issue little story in that early in that run where the Doom Patrol get lost in a painting and they go through all the different art movements and they're trapped in this painting. And this book reminds me of that. And I absolutely love it kind of because of that. And also because it stands on its own. I think Mike Allred is doing some amazing stuff, obviously. Visually
oh, totally.
Book,
I believe
so.
It. I don't even need to know what's in the book to know that he's doing amazing stuff.
Yeah. Well, Nick, what else did you read? Let us know.
Yeah. Let me see. What
give us at least one more. At least one
more.
Before.
Yeah, absolutely. I was definitely playing a bit of catch up as well as attempting to put a stab in a couple comic book bundles that sort of have been sitting around. And probably the other big thing is Dark Horse did like a Black Friday sort of thing, and they had a bunch of issues for $1. And I was like, all right, you know. $7 or $8. What can we find? And they had a bunch of the Aliens issues for $1, which I was like, well,
oh man,
I don't know if this is much of a deal. But what's really weird is that they're not technically they're issues and they're numbered like an issue. You know, it's like Aliens 13 or whatever, but they're technically arcs. I know that sounds really weird. So like Aliens number 7 is the Colonial Marines arc, and that's like 300 pages. And then like Aliens 6 or something is just like a 2-issue arc, and it's like 40 pages. I guess again, I went and did a bunch of massive research and found out that with the Aliens franchise, Dark Horse said, you know what, like, we're going to go with completely different writers and completely different art styles, and we'll put out issues whenever we want. We're not going to be obligated to some sort of, like, monthly schedule. So if we want to have one issue this year, and then maybe in, like, 3 years, we'll do two stories in Dark Horse Presents, and that'll qualify as the next quote-unquote issue slash arc. It's really weird. It's a really weird, and this is what confused me. I had to go dig this up to understand what the fuck I was looking at. I was like, why are there two years between these issues, and why is this one 20 pages, and why is this one 300? And that's why. Really weird, but they did it as sort of a quality control thing, and they said when someone else has got a story, then we'll put one out, but until then, this isn't going to be like a monthly thing, and I found that to be pretty interesting. So I basically went and found all of the huge, really big story chunks and got the most, you know, bang for my buck. And as for the stories themselves, much like when I was discussing the whole Ash and the Evil Dead shit, after you've read a couple, you realize that you can only do so much. And with aliens, it's usually innocent, unwitting people being attacked by aliens, or it's the people who are armed to the teeth attempting to get revenge for the innocent, unwitting people that were attacked by aliens, attempting to attack aliens, thinking they're prepared to fight aliens, when in fact aliens are just, you know, hard-boiled, you know, ready and oiled human, you know, eating fucking kill murder machine.
Got it.
And yeah, long story short, it really takes a unique writer to stray away from that or deliver something different.
Right. Right.
Have I found any stories like that? Not that much, but
is there ever like a middle ground where like the aliens are like out to hunt humans? Like I feel like there's got to be like a halfway point between like innocent bystanders versus super marines.
You're like semi-prepared people. Like, yeah, I think there might be aliens around here. Maybe I'll carry this gun.
Just in case.
No, they always catch you with your pants down, or you go in there guns blazing with the military. And
I see.
The end result in both scenarios is always the same. So,
gotcha.
And if long story short, if anything, I think it gives me a lot more. It's not to say some of these narratives are very old. And were put out at times when I think this trope wasn't as firmly established. But it gives me a lot more respect for Aliens, Fire and Stone, which I think did a massively wonderful, wonderful, wonderful job with things. And minor side note, Jordan very stupidly pointed out to me that Vault of Midnight has the book that collects all 17 issues of that.
Oh, man.
Oh, now I want that so bad, but it's like 50 right. bucks.
Oh, man. Yeah. That's killer. Well, okay. I've got like a bunch of other stuff that I wanted to talk about. But Constantine number 6 is probably the best comic book I've read in the last year, hands down.
Rossmo's return.
Rossmo's back on this book. Maybe just for the issue because it was kind of a standalone issue.
Hmm.
There are some shots of Constantine in that book that are just perfect. I tweeted one. And I'll put it in the show notes, but man, that issue, I cannot describe how fantastic and perfect that issue was, just as a comic book on the whole. But Dark Knight 3, Paul, before... I know we want to talk about one-shots at some point today, but The Dark Knight 3, number 1, came out, and Nick, I know you haven't read The Dark Knight Returns or Rises or any of the other ones, but, okay, Paul, I think you and I have very differing opinions about this. I feel it in my heart, and I'm really worried that we're going to not be friends after this because of...
No. Well, maybe we'll surprise each other.
So let's just set the scene, because I saw the DVD of the first one, and I haven't read either book. And but you know, it's another one of those things where I hang around enough people and consume enough media that I feel slightly informed enough to, you know, make a broad sweeping argument that's probably wrong.
So you won't be completely left out.
As I was telling Mike yesterday, like the second one is basically Batman versus Superman, the movie of which we've been inundated with trailers for the last couple months. And Batman,
to an extent.
Yeah, yeah, and like, so Batman fights Superman, and they basically, it's all the giant ruse. This book's been out for over a decade, so I don't think there's any harm in spoiling any of this.
No.
They basically fake Batman's death, and that's it. And so people think Batman's dead, and that's how it ends. Am I wrong, Paul? I'm sure there's some subtle political discourse I missed there about Reagan, but or not that subtle political discourse about Reagan. But otherwise,
I mean, you just about nailed it. I mean,
Batman's supposed to be dead, right? That's yeah. It.
Well, so I'm just gonna say, speaking of Dark Knight 3, you know,
yeah,
it's a total mess. It's a mess of a comic book.
Oh my! Yep,
it's a mess.
Okay. I love this.
Go for
no
it.
No qualifying words on that. I like this. I like this.
But here
so
we go.
Far. This is good.
It's interesting because it does a few things that I really, really like. And I'll start. Let's start with those. The things I really enjoyed about it. I enjoy seeing Andy Kubert draw Batman. I enjoy Andy Kubert drawing Batman beating the shit out of people. And if you enjoy that, there's plenty of that in this book to enjoy.
Sure.
I also really enjoy Batman stories that approach Batman as being an urban legend. You know, this might exist, he might not exist.
Oh, year one and stuff like that. That's what made year one fantastic for me.
Yeah, but and this book, you know, this book does that too. I really enjoy that type of story. My problems with the book,
go ahead,
of which there are many.
Just throw them at me.
So here's the thing: I've only ever read the other Dark Knight stories after the fact. I read Dark Knight Returns when I was a teenager, but it was already regarded as a classic.
Yeah.
I read Dark Knight Strikes Again or whatever years after it had been published, and it was regarded as a total misfire and a mistake. So that kind of colored my reading of those books.
Okay.
It's interesting reading this one and reading it in real time, thinking like, all right, I don't know where this stands in comparison to the other two yet. I only have a small bit of the story so far. What made Dark Knight Returns, the original one from 86, important was the way it changed the way people thought about telling a story visually. It's a visual book.
Okay,
and
I'll give
Frank
that.
Miller does a lot of cool stuff, a lot of experimentation. Dark Knight Strikes Again felt like DC saying, hey, Frank, we need another Dark Knight book. Make something up. He makes it up on the spot, but he's experimenting with visuals. It doesn't always work, but there are sequences of that book that I think are visually stunning. He's trying new things.
Yeah.
Dark Knight 3 feels even more phoned in and slapped together, but it's missing that sort of experimentation. It's too polished. It feels like a Brian Azzarello book. It feels like an Andy Kubert book. It's missing that sort of energy and vibrance that the other two, for better or for worse, at least had to make them interesting, if not good. Mike, does that match up with your take on it?
Oh, Paul, I got words, man.
Okay.
So, So, looking at it from like a comic book masterpiece sort of standpoint, again, I think you're accurate to say that like we're only seeing the first issue. We don't know how this is going to play out on the whole, you know. That being said, the visuals, I was saying this to Nick last night, and this is pretty much I still hold these thoughts to be true, despite it being like 2 a.m. when I was telling Nick this, because I was trying to convince him to read it for the show today. This doesn't feel phoned in to me. This feels like a conclusion to a story that never got resolution. This feels like the actual third act to the book that we never got. And especially with the end of, I won't spoil it, but the way that number one ended, there was so much. I didn't know what to expect out of this book, and it felt like Frank Miller had been sitting on this book for a long time, because it feels like the next day. Like, this feels like a natural progression of this series to me.
Okay.
And maybe it's because I haven't read the other two books in a long time, but in my mind, what I picture the original two Dark Knight books being, this feels like the next chapter in it, and it feels like the summation of everything that Frank Miller was trying to do and say about superheroes, not just Batman, but superheroes in general, also including the Atom mini story that was included in this book, right?
Right, right.
And on the one hand, I was just blown away at how much Kubert's art looked like Frank Miller's art. Like, there were panels in Dark Knight 3 that I thought Miller had to have drawn. There's no way that Kubert drew them, because if you look at them and compared them side by side with Miller's art, they looked identical in style. And maybe that was Kubert trying to emulate Frank Miller's style, because maybe the original intention was for Miller to draw it, and then, you know, the dude's sick and we don't know what's wrong with him, so he's not drawing it. But then if you read the Adam mini book that was drawn by Frank Miller, that the art styles are almost identical. I'm just blown away. There were panels that I, honest to God, thought it was Frank Miller's art, and they just gave all the credit to Kubert. And maybe Miller sketched them, or maybe Miller gave like roughs for the panels or and layouts.
I will say, I will just interrupt real quickly. Say that Klaus Janson as an inker is one of the inkers that I think radically he puts himself onto the pencils sometimes a little too much. So I wouldn't be surprised if that's why these two look so similar.
Yeah, probably.
Because he inks both. He's able to sort of add the Miller style to Kubert and bring out the Miller whatever in Frank Miller, you know, to make it look more like Dark Knight. So I think Klaus Janson's influence on the art is noticeable for me.
Yeah, that may very well be the reason why I think they look so similar. But I feel like all of the groundwork that they laid out in the first issue very, very much felt like an Azzarello book, and I totally agree with you there. It definitely felt like an Azzarello book. But the overall story, like the plot, like what I feel like they're trying to accomplish with this book feels like the final, like, nail in the coffin to end the chapter of this
Batman
story.
Probably not the
right
language to be using.
Yeah, I know. So I really enjoyed it. So I don't know. There were just moments where I was right back in that universe where I felt like it was the next day, like I said. So I don't know. I didn't think that a book could do that to me, like in such a with such distance or time between the two, you know, being published.
So I want to draw this parallel. And forgive me if it doesn't work. Forgive me if you don't follow it. Feel free to edit this portion out if it doesn't make sense. But last night I went to go see Creed, the new film based on the Rocky franchise.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So you're gonna say Rock Band. Now I don't want to see it.
I went to go see the band Creed, and it was really changed my viewpoint. No, I went to go see the movie Creed, and I'm a sucker for boxing movies. Yeah. I don't like boxing as a sport, but I love boxing movies, and I love Rocky. I love the first two Rocky movies. I loved Rocky Balboa, and I absolutely loved Creed. I thought it was fantastic, but I recognized that it's a formula. I knew every story beat, where it was going to happen. I saw them all coming. I knew how it was going to end. Mm-hmm. The Rocky franchise has a formula that works, and it works really well. But what makes movies like the first Rocky, Rocky Balboa, and especially Creed work is the way that the filmmakers, the director, is able to sort of color it a little bit differently. There are sequences in Creed that are some of the best film sequences I've ever seen in a boxing movie.
Yeah, even I've though heard the same itself, thing from reviews.
Yeah, the movie itself is very predictable, and I knew exactly what was going to happen, but I loved it despite that because of the artistic flair. And what I think the parallel here is between the early Dark Knight Returns and Dark Knight Strikes Again. Frank Miller's really trying and pushing the medium. He's trying new ideas. He's pushing what you can do in a comic book, and I didn't see that in this book. You know, and it's not to say it's going to be a bad story. And I think there's a chance for it to be a very good, satisfying conclusion to the now is going to be a trilogy. But it was missing the sort of weight, the creative, you know, sparks that the first two had for me.
So, okay. Yeah. But that Minotaur, though. All right. I mean,
that was pretty cool. I have to admit, that whole sequence is pretty cool.
Yeah, there was a very cool sequence with a Minotaur that like I was very. What? Like, it's so out of place, but then they add context to it. It's so great.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. I'm really excited for this book, though. I'm going to keep buying it like a sucker, and then I'm going to buy it in collection. I'm going to buy the deluxe trilogy all together in hardcover or something. I don't know. Whatever.
Yeah.
It's good. Like it's amazing. It's amazing Batman stories. Like, no matter what I think 3 ends up being, we still cannot we cannot ignore the fact that the first two Dark Knight books were like game changing for the entire like Batman DC franchise. So
I think that's DC's trying to spin this book too. Yeah.
Totally. Oh, totally.
Well, guys, it doesn't matter where this book goes. Just remember where it's been.
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, you know, I have pretty simple taste when it comes to Batman, and I think the appeal of the other two the earlier volumes of the trilogy, the appeal is the visual, visceral image of Batman just beating people up. And like I said, this book totally delivers on that front. So can't complain too much, I guess. Since I had a little more free time this week than usual, thanks to the holiday, I was actually able to read a few books that I had bought previously and let sit. And these were the one-shots that tied into the Justice League Dark Side War event that I keep raving about and talking about how good it is. So I picked up, I only picked up three of them, and I was able to read the Batman tie-in, so Justice League : Dark Side War : Batman, number one. Of one.
This is like that Star Wars thing where like the title is forever long just because they want to make sure that like they have to meet their colon quota for the year. But sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. So then also I also read Justice League : Dark Side War : Green Lantern number one of one.
So who worked on these books?
Well, these are the ones I picked up basically because of the creative teams. There were six tie-ins in total. I also bought the Flash one, but I haven't gotten a chance to read that one yet. Okay. But I bought these three because of the creative teams. There were three others that I just kind of ignored, basically because, you know, you're talking $4 a pop for a one-shot. It's kind of hard to justify sometimes, as much as I'm enjoying the event. The Batman one-shot was by Peter Tomasi, and I'm blanking on the artist's name, but it's the same artist that did Green Lantern Corps with Peter Tomasi all those years ago. This is kind of a reunion of that creative team. And that was good. It was kind of a riff on the classic Golden Age and Silver Age story where Batman goes to confront Joe Chill and tells Joe Chill, like, guess what? I'm Bruce Wayne. Like, you made me. It's always kind of a classic, like, story that they do every decade or so. And I enjoyed the sort of modern take on that. But the Green Lantern one-shot was amazing, and it's one of the best Hal Jordan stories I've ever read. I loved this comic so much. It's Tom King writing it with art by Evan Shaner, who's amazing. And
that is a good team.
It was a really good comic. And it's one of these things, like, even if it wasn't tied into an event I really enjoyed, I would have loved buying this comic off the shelf. Just 20 pages for, you know, $4. It was perfect. A perfect, perfect single issue. And it kind of made me think about how one-shots work. Are they simply additions to stories that you're already reading and enjoying, or are they something you kind of enjoy on their own? It's just a standalone issue.
Well, I think the question is, so I'm like jumping the gun on your question. Sorry, continue your question. I'm just so excited to say something I'm really curious because like we run into this a lot of the times with crossovers, and I don't necessarily want this to be a conversation about crossovers, but would you have bought this one shot had it not been the crossover? Because it feels like this is probably heavily laden in that story, or is it like totally independent? It just happens to have the Dark Side or Justice League : Dark Side War : like title over the top of it.
You know, reading it, I've been reading up the Dark Side War, and I'm absolutely loving it, but I feel you could buy this issue and enjoy it as a standalone, just Hal Jordan story. It functions that way.
Right.
Same thing with the Batman issue,
really. Hal Jordan staples, like, does he get really mad? Does he yell at Carol? Does he, like, get mad and go off to the airport to, like, fly his jet and let off steam to remind everyone that he actually has a normal job? Like, does it have all of this? Because that's Hal Jordan story.
Did you happen to read this as well? No.
Sorry, I've read enough Jeff Johns to know. Which, again, that's not to knock Jeff Johns. I think once Venditti took over, you realized how much you missed Jeff Johns. Everything had to be turned up to 11. So
right, yeah. No, I enjoyed it as a standalone story because it puts Hal Jordan in a situation where he has to make a very serious choice, and you get to understand what his mindset is based on the choice he makes. You know, he's basically offered a position as a new god, and I won't spoil anything, but it was a very, very well done single issue that I don't think you really need to know too much about the Dark Side War. It helps to know the background of the new gods and have a background in the Green Lantern mythos, obviously, but I would recommend anyone who's even not reading the Justice League series, if you like Green Lantern, if you like Hal Jordan as a character, check this book out. It works totally as a standalone one-shot issue.
Gotcha. See, that's the thing that like weirds me out about one-shots. I mean, I guess I would love the idea of a one-shot in the sense that like you could pick up this book and it's the full story all in one. But in this case, it sounds to me like maybe this one wouldn't be a good one for me to pick up if I just like grabbed it off the shelf off of your recommendation, because it feels like there's still a lot of context to it, which like begs the question, like, are one shots really one shots, or is the idea of a one shot like dead? I realize I'm like hijacking what you were saying, but
no, I mean, this is a good, you're making a good point, Mike, because something else I bought over the weekend on a whim was Mr. Miracle Special Number 1, which is a one-shot, but it was published back in 1987. I found it in the back issue bins. It was $3. It's by Mark Evaner, who was Jack Kirby's assistant back in the 70s.
Okay.
And it's drawn by Steve Rude, who's amazing and does an amazing sort of Jack Kirby pastiche in this book. Mr. Miracle is one of my favorite characters. I love the Jack Kirby version of that character.
Could you give me like background on Mr. Miracle?
Sure.
Because I've never heard of that character before.
So he was part of the New Gods that Jack Kirby created for DC back in the early 70s.
Okay.
And the short version is that he's a super escape artist.
All right.
He has sort of the alien technology of the New Gods, and he uses that to be an escape artist. And that's what this one shot was.
Awesome. Awesome.
It's fantastic. And I love this.
He just has to let himself keep getting captured and shit in order to be relevant. Oh, no, he's lost again. Why does this keep happening all the damn time?
I love this character, and this was great because it really felt like this is the reintroduction to the character. So in a one-shot, it's a little bit oversized. It's probably 40 pages.
Right.
They give you not only the setup that Mr. Miracle, who's married to Big Barda, and they're short on money, so he has to go back to doing magic tricks, escape routines for money.
He's just a super Harry Houdini.
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
Yeah. But he's not really doing the superhero thing, so he needs to make money, so he's doing the escape artist stuff on the side. And then you get nice flashbacks that give you his background. If you didn't know the character at all, this would tell you his origin from the start in about 40 pages, and set up a good story that has Darkseid and has all the New Gods, you know, in it as well.
Right.
And it was just a really tight, well-written one-shot that if you knew nothing about Mr. Miracle, this would be the book to read. They'd get you all caught up in 40 pages.
Gotcha.
For $3 from the back issue bin.
See, we don't. I feel like we don't have that anymore, unless you're getting like a standalone one shot comic that is from the like not from the big two, right? Would you guys say
exactly.
That like big two one shots nowadays are like you have to have, there's a ton of context to the story and they're just telling a one off, but there's a ton of backstory that goes into it.
No, I totally agree. That's why this book felt like such like a weird flashback. I'm like, they don't really publish books like this anymore that would give you the entire history of the character in 40 pages.
Right. Right. Yeah. And to that extent, I mean, Nick, in our show notes, you mentioned annuals. Like,
yeah.
Do we consider annuals to be one-shots or not? I mean, I feel like you had some thoughts on this.
Yeah. Well, as you guys were suggesting, it kind of makes me wonder if there's anything as like a quote-unquote, is there a pure one-shot anymore? Because it almost seems every single one-shot is tied into something. It's usually an event. With what Paul's talking about, the event is the Darkseid Wars, and with Valiant's fall of Bloodshot, fall of Exo Man of War, fall of Harbinger, those are all being couched in the event of Book of Death. So the idea of a quote-unquote pure one-shot largely doesn't exist, at least in my recollection. Of course, I fell down the rabbit hole like I do weekly and did a little bit of research and looked into at least, you know, what I'm most familiar with, which is DC, and looked at what they've been doing since the New 52, which, of course, is, again, something I'm more comfortable with. And, I mean, you had a couple. If you remember, Lois Lane had a one-shot. Joker's daughter had a one-shot. I'm trying to think a couple of the other ones. And there were a couple other weird random ones at the end of Arkham War, which if you remember, that was the tie-in to Forever Evil. There was a weird Batman versus Bane one-shot, just to wrap that up. So there were a couple things here and there. But by and large, really, there aren't that many. And I think that's because it's hard to... it's hard to sell them. You know, you've got to plug them. You got to plug them a ton, mm-hmm. and you've mm-hmm. got to get a lot of people. Again, I always stereotype big two people every week. I'm one of them to some extent, so I'm going to do it again. You have to get a lot of people whose pull lists are on autopilot on a very regular basis. You've got to convince them to look into what's coming out and talk to their shop and make adjustments, right. which I think is something you find more... being characterized as a non-big two trait.
I think when it comes to... you'd think... Okay, in theory, you would think that books like this would be easier to sell simply because they're supposed to be, you know, self-contained stories.
Self-contained,
and honestly,
yeah.
you'd right. think that they do a page of, like, recap in yeah. comic book style, similar to Jonathan Hickman or
sure.
the way that Invincible did their sum up in like issue, I can't remember what it was,
right.
just to catch readers up and say, okay, here's all the context you need about this story, or legitimately like go through their backstory in the first few pages and then
sure.
give the context of the story. Because the one shot should have no repercussions anywhere else. It should just be a one-off story. That's the idea.
Right.
If you want the
yeah,
continuous
but this
story,
is...
it should
yeah.
be in the fucking continuous book. I
right.
don't understand that.
Well, this is the sort of fickle bullshit that readers are. You know, they'll tell you that they want something that's approachable, but then when you don't honor canon, they're like, well, what are you doing? You know, we have canon for a reason. Why aren't you dealing with it?
That's where editor's notes come in. I don't know.
Yeah. And then you have the people that say, well, I'd like a new approachable story. And then they tell you that they don't want to see another origin story rehashing. And why are you wasting valuable
yeah.
pages
okay.
doing that? So these are the very reasons that I think one-shots are rare. I think what DC did with National Comics, and Paul, maybe you remember this. This was barely on anybody's radar. Mm-hmm. DC went and they launched a couple one-shots under their old National Comics imprint.
Really?
And they did one for Kid Eternity, and I mean they put mm-hmm. good people on this. Kid Eternity was Jeff Lemire and Cully Hamner. And one for Rose and Thorn,
wow.
and one for Madame X, and one for Looker. And these were meant to be backdoor pilots introducing these characters to the New 52. And then, mm-hmm. comically enough, to my knowledge, they never actually showed up in the New 52. That was it.
Yeah. you know,
and, for me, that's a pure one-shot. And I think that was a good use of a one-shot, even though it never fulfilled its purpose.
You know, that's interesting because I feel that's mainly just the way that the market works now, that there's not a place for one-shots for a lot of regular readers. You know, when I was reading comics as a teenager in the mid-90s, that's when the DC was doing Elseworlds, and a lot of those Elseworlds stories were one-shots, and that was the appeal because it was a standalone sort of alternate take on a character. And they were usually published as the prestige format. They had like the cardstock covers. They were
right.
square bound. They were like 80 pages or whatever. I wonder if maybe printing those types of books is too cost prohibitive. That
yeah.
could be.
A book, maybe something that used to be a prestige format where it'd be like 80 pages, square bound, a nice cover. They don't have the cost for that, so they'll just publish it instead as like a 3-issue or 4-issue miniseries.
yeah.
And before
yeah.
it'd just be a standalone one shot.
This is
go ahead,
Nick.
No, go ahead.
This is that whole like ideology. Like, what do you really want butting heads again? Because some people will tell you, well, wouldn't it be nice if we had books that took place in different universes or stood alone by themselves? And of course, that's somewhat to some extent what Convergence was. And then you have the New 52, which says no, everything needs to be in the same universe because that's more approachable. And so again, it's just butting heads
yeah.
in terms of what people want. And in some way, Convergence sort of was kind of a one shot, just a whole bunch of one shots, if you excuse the fact that they were technically two parts.
Two issues. Yeah.
But I mean, where is that's why I said maybe the annual is the one shot now, because to some extent they do stand
yeah.
alone. To some
yeah.
extent, they do try. Well, you find a lot of them casually or quickly remind you of an origin story to some extent, but they're still somewhat couched in canon. Like when I was thinking of this, I thought of the Batman I was telling Jordan, you know, the Batman and Robin annual number 3, you know, that still had canon to some extent. And he's like, really? And I said, Damian's alive in it. You know, that's technically an acknowledgement of canon. At that point, yeah. Damian had been brought back. And so to some extent, there's still some acknowledgement of ongoing canon, even though most people, you know, that turns into the whole debate, just like the whole debate about one-shots of, you know, is this really necessary to read?
Yeah. And maybe one-shots just aren't as approachable as they used to be in as far as the big two goes. I mean, yeah. I think we like most books don't get annuals anymore, or at least I should say at Marvel, but a lot of books don't get annuals. DC, yeah. It feels
at
like
DC,
every
it's
book
all about
gets an
sales.
Annual. Yeah.
It's all about yeah. sales. Yeah. You have but, to and, if your book is doing well enough, you get it.
The other side of this coin though, I think is independent comic book publishers that do one-off mm-hmm. books. Like for instance, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 years ago, Robert Kirkman published this series called Brit, and it was just a one-off 60-page little mini, almost like, I don't know, maybe it was like 80 pages, but it was just a one-off story about this character, wasn't tied to anything, and it sold pretty well, so they did a second one. Completely unrelated stories about the same exact person, and it almost felt like the way that Hellboy is published, where they're like about the same character in the same universe, but the continuity isn't so much important because this guy's indestructible and like he's going to be the same person in both stories. And yeah, in Hellboy there is continuity and things like that, but in Brit it was this guy, he works in Canada, he fights big monsters, that's his day job, and that was the whole story, and it was really cool. And I think that those work if you try, like if the intention is to just tell a story and add no continuity to it, like you want this to be completely unrelated to anything. It's an independent one-off story that will never be touched again and will only be touched for a moment. But obviously that isn't economically savvy if you're trying to make a lot of money or make money in general, I guess, in comics. But I don't know. I as much as I want to say I would love to see more one-off stories, I realize that as soon as I get a one-off story that I really like, I'm going to want more of it. And then it's no longer a one-off and it becomes the origin of a character, and then we're back at the same kind of problem. So maybe we're at this point where one-shots aren't a big thing anymore because nobody wants just one story about one thing.
Yeah.
Unless we get into like weird Elseworld stories or Marvel what-ifs and things like that. But then again, back at the big two, we've already kind of established that we don't want that because we want continuity.
Yeah, and it reminds me a lot of what Paul said in the last week or two about the modern market really demands the arc format. That's it.
Yeah.
If you're, you know, arcs turn into trades, arcs tend to keep readers longer than anything else, and the arc is the way to really make money and survive as a company this day, because you can just have people, you know, pulling a book month after month after month.
Yeah.
And in a way, the one-shot, we've talked in the past about these OGNs that aren't even released as, you know, they aren't even savvy enough, if you want to use savvy, aren't even savvy enough to release themselves in singles, and it's just an OGN like Superman Year One or something or whatever. And I mean, that book clearly must be doing okay. It's on volume 3. But that being said, the one shot is the even less approachable cousin of the OGN.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, OGNs, really? I think, or I should say original graphic novels, OGNs, you know, they've definitely replaced the one shot in the sense that they're longer form, they can be sold at a higher price, and can be printed in mass volume, you know, whereas single issues, I think, are way more costly to print, but they are quicker to produce. You know what I mean? And unless they sell in a huge volume, then we, like, there's no point to them. And that's why I'm looking over at my bookshelf as I'm listening to you talk, Nick, and I realize all of the books that I have that are kind of waiting for me to read are all one-off original graphic novels that I picked up from independent publishers, because when I think of quality original graphic novels, I think about, you know, Brian Lee O'Malley's Seconds is the first one that I see, or any of the Matt Kent one-off books that are just not tied to anything, or Jeff Lemire's one-off books that are not tied to anything. Those are super duper high quality books, and they're standalone. They have no ties to anything else, and I don't think at the big two it's even fathomable anymore.
Thanks for listening to the I Read Comic Books podcast, a production of Destroy the Cyborg. This episode was produced by Mike Rappin and edited by Xander Riggs. This week's music was brought to you by Free the Robots, The New Law, Six Fingers, and Infinity Shred. If you'd like to keep current with the I Read Comic Books podcast, you can subscribe to it on iTunes and Stitcher. And while you're there, take a quick moment to rate us. If you have a topic you'd like us to talk about, or if you just want to say hi, you can email the show at cyborg@destroythecybe.org. Also, feel free to shoot us a message on Twitter at @destroythecybe, follow us on Tumblr at destroythecyborg.tumblr.com, and check out our subreddit at ireadcomicbooks.reddit.com. And as always, thank you for listening.